Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we talk to Priscilla Presley about her upcoming visit to Milwaukee to share stories about Elvis, Graceland, and living life in the spotlight.
First, Kewaunee County residents have been dealing with contaminated drinking water for more than a decade. Assessments show that as many as 30% of private wells consistently have unsafe levels of pollutants associated often with agricultural runoff, including bacteria, high nitrate levels, or both. While not the only source, area dairy operations are widely seen as a large part of the problem.
In 2014, several environmental groups petitioned the Environmental Protection Agency on behalf of residents for a plan to correct the conditions and to provide clean drinking water to the affected households. But the EPA and the state's Department of Natural Resources have been slow to respond to what an administrative law judge has characterized as a massive regulatory failure.
Democratic U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin of Wisconsin has been following this issue and convened a meeting yesterday of governmental representatives to press for action on behalf of residents whose drinking water has been impacted. She joins us now. Senator Baldwin, thanks for taking the time.
My pleasure.
Well, what happened at this meeting yesterday?
Well, this was an opportunity to bring some of the stakeholders and citizen participants in the working group that has been meeting to develop plans to address the crisis, and federal representatives. There's several federal agencies that play a role in these solutions. And so, as you note in the introduction, citizen petitioners pressed the EPA to address the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources response in Kewaunee County and compel them to better address the groundwater contamination issues. As a result, the EPA directed DNR to improve their response, which resulted then in the establishment of a groundwater collaboration work group. Most of the subgroups submitted reports in June of this year that involve some short-term actions, longer-term actions, some assigned to local officials, some to state officials, and some to federal officials. What I really wanted to do was have representatives of these federal agencies in the room with these work group members so that they could have a conversation, identify action steps and the timetable for implementation, and ask each other questions. People are talking to each other all the time, but this was really helpful to have everyone in the same room. And so we essentially went through work group by work group, talking about the federal expectations, having a back and forth between representatives of the EPA, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and the U.S. Geological Survey. It was very eye-opening, and I understand the frustrations with how slow this has been.
And that's been a concern for residents in Kewaunee County, that this has been taking a while. They're looking for action from someone. I don't know if people care if it's the DNR or the EPA or the USDA. Why do you get the sense that a solution to the water problems that people have been talking about for a while is so long in coming?
Well, I can give you an example that shows how cumbersome this can be. There is a federal safe drinking water law that requires polluters to remediate contaminated drinking water. However, it hasn't been invoked in the case of Kewaunee County because it only is invoked once a clear source of a pollutant has been identified. So part of the struggle has been how the testing has proceeded countywide, how they're able to pinpoint the polluters. And they haven't been able to do that yet, although that was part of our discussion yesterday, was how the federal government, in this case the U.S. Geological Survey, could work hand-in-hand with state and local officials to get a clearer idea of how and when we can invoke the Safe Drinking Water Act. In the meantime, there's still responsibility that lies on the shoulders of other actors, and there's some emergency things that need to happen. The first thing we discussed was the goal of having clean water for residents whose wells are currently contaminated. As you said, almost a third of those living on private wells are facing these problems, and it shouldn't be a burden on their shoulders to pay for solutions. This is something that we've got to move forward on. And there was an encouraging discussion, but no, what we heard yesterday, which piqued everybody's interest in the room, is that EPA is, I think, in the final stages of coming up with something that they hope will be a solution for this clean water issue in terms of providing people on contaminated wells with a source. But they weren't ready to announce it because it hadn't been finalized. But we discussed a whole host of other things that were really immediate needs in Kewaunee County.
We're talking to U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin about water problems, contaminated wells in Kewaunee County here in Wisconsin. So you mentioned that short-term solution. Yeah, that piqued our interest, too. Headlines saying that clean water supplies were imminent, though the EPA hasn't defined what that is. How about on the longer-term front? Is there a sense that we're working toward connecting the dots, saying, okay, we've got this contamination in the wells. We think we know where it's coming from. We're going to change regulations, laws, enforcement, what, to try to get those pollutants out?
Yeah, so going back to the issue of identifying the source, because obviously you want to prevent this, not just remediate a crisis, right? So there was discussion about funding for testing. Testing is not inexpensive. It requires personnel on the ground. There was also a robust discussion about folks being out enforcing the current laws regarding spreading of manure, et cetera. There was a real interesting discussion about mapping the county. There's a unique geology in this area of Wisconsin that certainly contributes to this problem that you might not face in another county with a different type of geology. It's sort of a thin layer of topsoil on fractured rock, and so you can see how and understand how the contaminants get into the groundwater very, very quickly. And there's a robust discussion, but none of this comes inexpensively. And I heard a lot about the timetable for the next state biennial budget and how soon they can get the DNR providing more boots on the ground, if you will.
As we wrap up, you've talked to local constituents. What kind of things are you hearing from them? How are they feeling about this this water issue?
Well, certainly you can imagine it depends on who you're speaking with. And so, first and foremost, people who live, the place they call home, if they turn on the faucet and they can't trust that that water is safe to drink, safe to bathe in, safe to cook with, that's a very traumatic event. And I certainly hear those voices really in some cases quite desperate, in other cases very hopeful that by collaborating we can get solutions. But they're also, and I just have to talk about the heroes on the ground. This working group, people spent hundreds of hours, literally, over the course of well over a year, coming up with these recommendations, identifying which actors need to take steps. And so part of my role yesterday is to make sure that we are clear that these steps are being implemented in a timely fashion, where there's gaps, identifying them and seeing what we can do to close them.
Senator Baldwin, thanks a lot for being with us today.
Thank you.
That's U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin, Democrat from Wisconsin. She joined us to talk about the ongoing concerns about contaminated drinking water and efforts to solve these problems in Kewaunee County.
Well, bless my soul, what's wrong with me? I'm itching like a man on a fuzzy tree. My friends say I'm acting wild as a bug. I'm in love. I'm all shook up.
Elvis may be gone. This week marks the 39th anniversary of his death, but his legions of fans have kept his memory and his music alive. Graceland is one of the top tourist attractions in the country, and hundreds of books have been written about Elvis.
Now, Priscilla Presley, the former wife of Elvis Presley, is sharing new home movies, pictures, and stories about her life with Elvis in a new touring event called Elvis and Me. It's coming to Milwaukee's Pabst Theater on the 20th of August, and Priscilla Presley joins us now. Welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure.
Well, let's start by having you describe a little bit what you're bringing to Milwaukee. It's your focus will be something, a presentation called Elvis and Me, an evening with Priscilla Presley, and you're sharing things you haven't shared before. What can people expect?
Oh my gosh, so much more. I've spoken before about I'm feeling much more comfortable with speaking more about Elvis and myself, and I feel that I get so many questions from so many people and get emails and letters sent to me just curious about my life and how I was able to handle living the right life of rock and roll at such a young age. And what are my secrets? What advice can I give? How did I open up Graceland not knowing, you know, anything about the business world? How did I maintain that throughout, you know, his legacy and continuing? So I think I have a lot to offer. I think I have a lot, you know, of advice. I think I can answer questions in a way that people can really understand and duplicate. I think that I get a lot of questions from women, you know, raising two children and the life of rock and roll. How is that? Because you hear so many stories about, you know, children of celebrity. Just really down to earth, very good questions that I'd like to share with them, or the answers with them.
And you've decided, as you said, you're comfortable enough to be open, and so some of the things you'll be sharing will be home movies and photographs. What made you decide to share these things?
Well, because I think when you're speaking or talking and you have a visual, it's much easier. I have home movies of my life. I have home when I was younger. I have home movies of Elvis and I together at play, what it was like behind the scenes at Graceland. Just pictures that are heartwarming. I think they're, of interest to the audience. I do an opening up. No, I'm not I'm just opening up and throwing everything out there, but I'm opening up everything that I feel that is curious to the audience or that I've had to answer many times throughout my life.
And it's interesting because
I think it's an education. It'll be an education for the audience to really know the story behind the scenes instead of, oh, so many books. I had no idea that Elvis, you know, when I said, how many books do we have out on Elvis now? Because every time I read the paper, it seems like somebody's writing a book. There's over 800 books written on Elvis.
Wow.
800, and it's mind-boggling. And so many untruths about him that's out there. And these are people who've written books from that they heard hearsay or things from other people, or they've taken that of other people's lives and made their own books. And there's a lot of untruths and a lot of stories that need to be told that are truthful. And I am very honest. So,
can you give us an example of one of these stories that's not true that you want to set right?
Well, there was many. I mean, you have to give me the one of them was just that someone just toured upstairs at Graceland, and it was just beautiful to go up there and see his bedroom. I mean, that's not true. You know, I've heard this story a number of times that people go up and have seen the room, and it's not true. That true is that room was his sanctuary, the upstairs, and it's locked. And no one goes up there really unless it's a family. So that was an untruth, and that's been out a few times I've heard that someone told them that they went upstairs. Can we go up? How do we get up there? Well, you can't. So it's just stories like that. It's just like to fill that gap, like that vacant spot that needs to be, with truth needs to be put in.
Speaking of all those books that have been written, over 800 books, I mean, for most people with their partner, that partnership is something that they share that is maybe private. With you, does it feel like your relationship has been opened up to the world? You've had to share the relationship with the world, and
how
does that change things?
Absolutely, and I have been very, very private about my life. Not that I'm exposing absolutely everything about my life. I don't, and that's for me. And you know, I've had wonderful moments with Elvis, and he trusted me a lot. But I think the things that I'm sharing that they're my private, like, let's say, photos, and they're home movies that I think he'd be very happy for me to share. I don't think I'm revealing anything that is, let's say, that was personal between him and I. That will always be personal between him and I. But our life has been an absolute open book, not as much as it is in this generation, obviously, with social media. And everything is out in the open. Celebrity, everything needs to be known about the celebrity, as people are very celebrity-driven and are curious about the celebrity. I'm sharing things that are heartwarming. I'm sharing things that I would love people to know about Elvis Presley that would make them love him even more. I'm sharing things, I'm putting truth in that's out there that has been so blown out of proportion that I feel needs to be said.
Now, you mentioned Graceland earlier. Could you talk a little bit about what went into turning it from a home into what's really a pilgrimage site today for Elvis fans?
But it's still a home. It is still a home, and my family goes there after hours when the gates are closed and all public has been out. We still go in and have dinner. We still congregate with our friends there. My daughter has spent the night. I have spent the night there. So it's still a home to us. Even though people go through and people visit and people, you know, are still very, very curious and interested and come back more than once. I had someone who had been back 23 times because there's a certain magic at Graceland that draws people to it, just like it draws us back as a family. So we have cooks that come in and cook for us. Hmm. We really look at it as our home.
I didn't know that it was still functioning as a home. So what made you, since it is clearly something that's still special to you, that is a home, why did you want to open it up to the public and let people walk through?
Because at that time, after Elvis died, and I became executor, one of the executors to the estate, we were absent of any finances. And I had a big decision to make back in 1981. We're told that we were having to sell it because the government was coming into town, the state was coming in to take it. I had to think of some way to keep it, some way that, you know, to keep Graceland, which was his sanctuary, going. So that was a way of doing it. And it's been absolutely, I mean, we have over 800 visitors a year. And Elvis was really the first tour guide. Anyone that visited his home, he showed them all over the rooms, everything, you know, even going back to the stables. He was proud of his horses. So we're just carrying on his tradition.
We're talking with Priscilla Presley right now. She'll be in Milwaukee on Saturday, August 20th. And she'll be giving a presentation about her life with Elvis, sharing home movies and photographs and telling stories. And Priscilla, one thing I know you'll be getting to is this experience you had raising a daughter amid the rise of the tabloids, where everything began to change for celebrities. What was that like for you?
Invasive, untruthful, sensationalism. I will talk about that, too. I actually have tabloids that I'm bringing that were the covers of the magazines. Of course, I couldn't bring them all because there were thousands of stories that were coming out. That was difficult. That was very, very hard, raising a child, being a young mother, and having the life exposed, and trying to keep it as private as possible. And when I say private, having a private life, being able to go to the movies, going out shopping, all that stopped. You know, especially after Elvis died, our life was like the media was trying to make it an open book and trying to keep my daughter away from the press. I left the country for a month to keep her away from tabloids because they are cruel, mean, and untruthful. So, and still to this day, you know, stories are written. They find a little truth in something and fill in all the gaps. And I think that's been the hardest thing to cope with.
So clearly there have been some hardships coupled with this relationship with fame that Elvis brought along. Do you ever wish you could have just been a normal family where the parents just went to work or stayed home and one of them wasn't a colossal rock star? Ever wonder what might have been?
I think there were. I mean, I had to accept the life, obviously. I had to accept that life early on. And in fact, someone had asked what it was like to be, you know, life at such a young age thrown into the life of rock and roll. And it's definitely a roller coaster ride. But life is a roller coaster ride. So it's not like everyone has it easy and life just, you know, is just great. I mean, every one of us, all of us, have our stories. and I'm in no way, you know, I'm having to, you know, you have to basically what you've been thrown, you try to are given, you make it work the best you possibly can, if it can. And my life has been as much of a roller coaster ride as everyone else's, I'm sure. Only mine was public.
You're still talking about Elvis, of course, years after he's died. The world is still interested in him, still loves him. Since he is so present for you, what do you miss most about him from day to day?
Him. I mean, he was a rock. He was the, not just for me, but for everyone, really, that even worked for him. Me, of course, as his wife. Me, of course, as his friend. We remained very, very close after our divorce. Him still telling me things that maybe his fears or why he wasn't happy about someone or something. You know, it's just he. My life was so much a part of his that it's hard to, and I'm still to this day living it, as I'm still involved with Graceland and all the people involved. So it's still very present to me. It's almost as if he's still here, and I'm still carrying out. I know things that he would have wanted, and I think too with questions that people not only ask about with Elvis, they ask about, you know, how I, as a young girl, and who I am today, and what I've accomplished. How did all that happen? So I want to, for women, for men, even, to go in that area. I think it's inspiring in a way to be able to come out and offer my life and how it changed in so many ways, which I never thought of, and give that to others.
Priscilla, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you very much. I appreciate the time.
Priscilla Presley is an actress, businesswoman, and the former wife of Elvis Presley. Her new event, Elvis and Me, is coming to Milwaukee's Pabst Theater on Saturday, August 20th. Listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. While violent crime has gone down in the United States over the last few decades, there are still troubling acts of violence in public mass shootings, acts of domestic violence, and recent increases in violence in some urban areas around the country.
In the aftermath of high-profile violence, especially mass shootings, there is a public discussion about the causes, often looking at mental health, access to firearms, or extreme ideology. But a number of experts are pointing toward another common factor: anger, and poor management of that anger.
Our next guest studies anger and how we deal with it for better and for worse. Ryan Martin is a professor and chair of psychology at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay. His podcast is called All the Rage. Ryan, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, before we get into anger itself, Ryan, I want to talk about the idea that comes up, it seems like every time there's a mass shooting, that mental illness is the cause. We need to screen better for mental illness. That mental health problem connection is a lot of times the first thing in our mental toolkit. Are we too quick to point to that, given that, as experts say, most people who have mental illness, mental health problems, will not commit an act of violence?
Yeah, that there's plenty of data to suggest that is simply not the case, and that we just need to focus on other predictors. Of course, you know what I think a lot of times people will point to is they'll say something along the lines of, "Well, don't you have to be mentally ill to be willing to do that?" or something along those lines. I mean, of course, if that's, you know, if you're using that sort of circular definition, then yeah, mental health illness is relevant, but that's not the definition that mental health providers use. You know, when we talk about most types of mental health problems, what we see is there is actually a decreased likelihood of being violent. And in fact, some cases, actually two times the likelihood of being the victims of violence.
So let's talk about anger. Is that a more productive thing to focus on as a predictor of violence, and maybe as a way we can help prevent violence?
Absolutely. You know, I think ultimately what we see is that when we're talking about people and we're talking about violence, there's lots of reasons why human beings can be violent. Some of it is predatory. Some of it is self-defense. Some of it is part of an activity or job or sport or things like that. But often it's related to emotion, and more specifically, it's related to anger. Anger is almost, by definition, the emotion associated with the desire to lash out. And people sometimes will lash out verbally, they'll sometimes lash out physically, but and of course, sometimes they don't lash out at all, they're able to control that, but usually there is an urge to in some way.
It's tricky because anger, I think, is one of those emotions that's just part of the territory. It comes with being human. How do we distinguish between normal, healthy violence or anger, I'm sorry, if there is such a thing, versus anger that crosses the line and may lead to violence?
Yeah, I think we can. And, you know, I'm far from someone who would suggest that anger is always a problem. In fact, I try and talk a lot about the value of anger and the way in which it alerts people to the fact that they've been wronged, the way it energizes us to confront an injustice. However, you know, to get to your question about how can we distinguish between healthy and unhealthy anger, so often I think a way to do that is to explore what some of the consequences have been. And so if you are, you know, getting into a lot of physical fights, if you are frequently having damaged relationships, if you are driving poorly as a consequence, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and that's happening to you a lot, then you might need to think about whether or not your anger is productive or maladaptive.
Do you think people are usually pretty good at self-diagnosing when anger is a problem?
No, I don't necessarily think that people usually are. I think people have a tendency, when it comes to anger in particular, more so I think than most emotions, they have a tendency to blame it on other people. So you hear from angry clients a lot, well, I wouldn't have an anger problem if other people weren't always, you know, making me mad, or if other people weren't always screwing up. You know, there's this pinning it on others. And so I do think people with that emotion in particular, they tend to externalize, which of course is, that's the nature of anger, right, is externalizing and blaming in a lot of ways. And so ultimately, you know, one of the things I think therapists who are working with angry clients are really working toward is helping them develop that kind of insight, helping them understand their own anger, where it comes from, and so on.
Talking to Ryan Martin from UW Green Bay, looking at anger and anger as a cause of violence. And Ryan, let's talk about dealing with that anger once somebody recognizes that they have a problem. There's often a notion, and maybe this is a pop culture thing, that what happens is you bottle up your anger too long and then it explodes. You need to vent that anger. Anger's a steam engine, I guess. Is that in your research? Is that true?
No, that is most certainly a myth. In fact, it's such a common myth, it has a name. We call it the catharsis myth. This idea that, you know, you need to let your anger, it's that pressure cooker metaphor that you need to let some steam out every now and then or else you'll explode. And ultimately what we see is that there are infinite ways of dealing with anger, and none of them have to be yelling, screaming, hitting, kicking, swearing, or anything like that. Those are versions, and there may even be a right time for those sorts of things. But a lot of times we can think of really productive pro-social ways of dealing with anger. Journaling, playing music, exercising, writing letters to the editor, protesting, and so on.
So finding more productive ways to harness, to be motivated by that anger, I guess, but not driven by it.
Exactly. I mean, when I think of anger, along with all emotions, I think of them as motivators, that it is one of the mechanisms your body has for telling you that you need to do something. And so the same way fear alerts us to danger, anger alerts us to the fact that we may have been wronged.
I want to get more into some sort of, I guess, individual ways people can deal with anger, but I want to look at a wider society-wide level. Are there things we can do? I don't know, policies or cultural changes or something that can help us control our anger and hopefully then prevent acts of violence?
Yeah, I think there are. I mean, I think, you know, if we look at situations like the Milwaukee uprisings and things like that, I think what we're seeing is a culture and a group of people who feel marginalized, who feel helpless, who feel powerless. And I think that you know, the policy strategies have to be about addressing those sorts of issues. And so I think that those are things we need to look at. If you have large groups of people who are feeling marginalized, exploited, and so on, then policy has to be about exploring what's going on there and what can be done about it.
And how about when we think of the mass shooters we've seen lately, it seems like there's very often a sense of resentment against them and the them, and it varies from individual case to individual case, women, immigrants, the U.S. government, conspiracy theories, things like that. At that level, is there something we could do to reach the people who might be prone to commit a mass act of violence?
I don't know if there's been a whole lot of success in that sort of approach. Part of the problem is that when we're dealing with those kinds of mass acts of violence, mass shootings and so forth, what we see is that it's almost like predicting a car accident, that we're talking about something that is relatively rare, and it's very difficult to actually pinpoint when it's going to happen. You're going to have what we'd call a lot of false positives, where you essentially recognize, well, there's a group who's at risk, but that group, or you know, a type of person who might be at risk, but that type of person isn't, you know, there's lots of them, and they probably aren't necessarily going to act.
Is there an outreach strategy, I guess, for people dealing with anger at any level that might say, hey, there are ways to deal with this problem, as you're maybe doing in your podcast?
Mm-hmm. I do think that's really important. I mean, part of the goal of the podcast, which we've had a few kind of preview episodes, but it will become official in early September. I think part of the goal of the podcast, as well as the blog that accompanies it, is to help people better understand this emotion, help people understand the link between anger and violence. I do think that is really important. I don't know that we haven't seen as many attempts at addressing anger as we have addressing anxiety or depression or other real common emotional experiences.
But when I think of talk about depression, anxiety, things like that, I mean, in a way, there's a medical approach to those. There are medications. Mm-hmm. Is there a risk of medicalizing, again, a normal human emotion if we think of anger that way?
Yeah, I do think that's been part of the resistance, too. So anger is not in a real significant way reflected in the diagnostic and statistical manual of mental disorders, certainly not the way depression and anxiety are, which have many, many diagnoses associated with them. And the downside of its lack of representation is that while I recognize the concern about medicalizing a normal human emotion, the downside of it not being there is it's received far less attention in the research. And so if you were to look at kind of just how many articles are written about those emotions every year, what you'll see is you know, less than 20% of the articles, you know, compared to depression, are about anger. And so we're seeing that this emotion, which I think we all acknowledge is important to study and to better understand, is just receiving a lot less attention.
Ryan Martin is with us. He's a psychology professor at UW Green Bay, and we're talking about anger and how anger may contribute to violence and what we can do about it.
You can join our conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you see a problem with anger in our society and maybe your community? Do you think it's a cause of mass shootings and other violence? And what can we do about it? How do you manage anger in your daily life? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're talking to UW Green Bay psychology professor Ryan Martin about anger and the link between anger and violence.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you deal with anger in your daily life? Do you think we as a society do a bad job dealing with anger? What could we do to get better at it? Have you or someone close to you figured out how to control that anger? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to our callers now. We've got Heather on the line in Madison. Heather, hi.
Good afternoon. I've got a question for the professor, and it really is a question that covers the nuance between anger as being an emotion that's triggered by just whatever you're experiencing in the environment versus anger that can be perceived as anger, but it's really somebody's excessive need to have control. So, for example, a domestic abuse situation.
a domestic violence situation. Heather, thank you for that call. So, Ryan, people deploying anger as a tool of control, she's saying.
Yep. Yeah, and people most certainly do use anger that way. I would argue that it's still the same emotion. But one of the things I didn't get to in that first segment was the emotion is always rooted in our appraisal of situations, and that appraisal is informed by the type of people we are, right? And so a person who has a high need for control, then they're going to appraise, maybe a spouse seeking independence or a child seeking independence, they're going to appraise that in a way of, well, I'm losing control, and so they're going to want to try and clamp down on that. But anger is always kind of rooted in our perception of reality or our appraisal of situations.
Heather, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go next to Marcus in Green Bay. Marcus, hi.
Hi, I was just wondering what the guest feels about anger being glamorized or like it's cool. And certain television shows, certain radio programs, news commentators, even one of our presidential candidates is like, we're supposed to be mad and it's really cool, or, you know, hate and stuff. You know, I was flipping through the channels and there's some show on where two people are just arguing and pointing their fingers and yelling and anger, and it's like, you know, it's a neat thing to do or something. So what do you think about that?
Marcus, thanks for the call. What do you think, Ryan?
I think that's a great question, and I think it's a really great perception or thing to notice. I do think we've seen a lot of that, and I think some, you know, just off the top of my head, some examples, characters from the show Entourage, Ari Gold, characters, I think some of the reality TV shows, a lot of times the hosts have kind of a cruel anger to them. I think it's unfortunate because so much of, when we talk about anger and when we talk about violence, one of the things we see is that modeling matters and what people watch and what they think is cool and what they think is funny and interesting matters. And so I do get concerned sometimes about that kind of cruelty being popularized and that kind of approach being glamorized that way.
But how about if a political activist, wherever they are on the spectrum, is saying, here is a problem we should be angry about, and here are the actions we could take, as long as they're not, you know, agitating for negative, violent behavior, couldn't that be a positive force ultimately?
Yes. No, I think that's a really good and important point. I do think there is plenty to be angry about when you look at society and when you look at politics and when you look at government and so on. I do think there is plenty for us to be angry about. My concern, I guess, is more when that rhetoric turns violent and turns aggressive. It's one thing to say, hey, we should all be upset about sexism or racism. That is something different, I think, than the type of glamorized sort of cruelty that we oftentimes see on television and elsewhere.
And Ryan, before we get back to our callers, on the subject of anger in the media, you've talked recently in the press about the impact of violent videos that go viral, whether it's of a crime or a police shooting or things like that. What kind of effect does seeing those kind of sadly real life videos have on people?
Yeah, I think, the short answer is I don't think we know what kind of effect they're going to have because it's such a new experience. I do think, though, that, based on what we've seen before, I do think there is a sense that we're going to that people kind of become used to that sort of violence. And I think that a lot of people have already, people I've talked to have already started acknowledging that in their own lives, that they've seen enough videos of, say, police brutality or enough videos of fights or aggression or violence that they're at a point now where they see it and they say, oh, well, it's just another one of those videos or something like that. And so they've really become desensitized to that. But I do think that is such a new experience. And my suspicion is that for many people, the first time they've ever seen a dead body was on, a Facebook video or something like that they were scrolling through. And I think that's a new experience that human beings are having now that they didn't have before.
Talking to Ryan Martin, psychology professor at UW Green Bay, about anger, the anger's connection to violence, and how we can deal with our anger. And we'll go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Randy is on the line in Galena, Illinois. Randy, hi.
Hi. I am so excited that my anger has been given an actual identity. It is an IED, which is appropriate. It's the intermittent explosive disorder. And I will be in the small percentage of people that your expert has said don't build up anger and then explode, because my background is Native American and Irish. So I'm stoic to a point, and then when it reaches that point, I somewhat explode. Just kind of fun to have it acknowledged as an actual disorder.
And do you think that knowing is half the battle? Are you finding you're able to get it under control, Randy?
Well, you know, you always try to do that in any situation like this, but I fear it's genetic.
Well, Randy, thanks and good luck to you. Ryan, this idea of intermittent explosive disorder, Randy says he's got that diagnosis. Is that common? Is there something people can do about that?
Yeah, so I want to clarify something I said in the previous segment related to this, too. So intermittent explosive disorder is a disorder in the DSM that many people with anger problems are diagnosed with. What's interesting about that is that it's not really an anger disorder so much as it's an aggression or violence disorder. And what I mean by that is that the emotion piece isn't really mentioned as part of the criteria. So it's fitting for people who have a very particular type of anger problem, meaning they get angry and they explode. And it doesn't nicely address people who get angry and stew about it or hold it in or, you know, make themselves nauseous or sick or things like that. It's actually some researchers have proposed an alternative called anger expression rumination disorder, where you would... would better capture some of those other phenomenon.
And mentioning rumination reminds me, on your website, your blog, Ryan, you talk about advice for dealing with that idea of rumination, which I assume means you're angry about something and you're nursing that anger, that grudge, whatever it might be. How can people break that?
Yeah, that's a real... I actually think this is one of the bigger challenges for people. Is to break that the rumination cycle, because it basically means you're kind of stewing over a situation and really just sort of living in that anger, repeating, kind of running through the story in your head over and over and over again. And it becomes really difficult because it's so much easier for people to control behaviors than it is their own thoughts, and that becomes hard. There's various strategies people can use. Sometimes it's deep breathing. Sometimes it is mindfulness. And in fact, I think there's a lot of research on mindfulness that has pointed to it being successful in helping people deal with rumination. But another approach is, I oftentimes think of anger as being, it's alerting you to a problem. And sometimes trying to find a way to solve whatever that problem is can be one of the best approaches to moving forward.
And a caller named Richard in Blair, I don't have time to put him on the air, but Ryan, he's saying parents need to model better anger control for children. Can that be part of the answer here for us as a society, for us to model less angry behavior to each other?
Yep, and it is. I take it a step further and simply say there is one of the key findings related to all emotions is that parents who express and display happy emotions have kids who express and display happy emotions, and vice versa. And so finding ways to model healthy, appropriate anger is really important. You know, I think we see that we oftentimes talk about the cycle of violence. We talk about, kids who see domestic violence or see abuse or experience domestic violence and abuse, and they end up being abusive as well. I think we could probably say the same thing about a cycle of anger. That expressing anger or seeing anger expressed in a maladaptive, unhealthy way leads to kids doing the same.
Very briefly, Ryan, you're trying to get experts, researchers talk about anger. Is this catching on? Are people listening to you?
Yeah, I think so. I think we're seeing a lot more interest in anger and in the emotion. I think that's really important as we go forward. There are lots of good people across the country who've been studying this for a long time, and I'm real excited to be part of that group.
Ryan, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That's Ryan Martin, professor and chair of psychology at UW-Green Bay. His podcast about anger, in the works still, All the Rage, is linked on the Central Time Facebook page.
There are lots of fancy and often expensive trends out there when it comes to weddings, but WKOW-TV reported this week on a wedding twist that's got a distinctly Wisconsin flavor.
It is cheese in the form of a cake. Not a cheesecake, but a cake-shaped arrangement of wheels of what look to be fancy cheese.
Pretty genius when you think about it. Cheese does come in the, you know, giant capacity sizes, and these beautiful wheels, why not stack them up and have a cheese wedding cake?
I'm all for it, with the caution that there also has to be a real cake. If I take the time to go to a wedding, and I don't like going to weddings, there's got to be cake at the end of it frosting.
Well, if you go to, I think, some European countries, cheese is dessert. So how would you feel about a wedding cake of actual cake and also a cheese kind of dessert?
I would fully endorse that. You would be very happy. Would you, going back, would you have done a cheese cake, not a cheesecake, a cake of these cheeses?
You know, it's very tempting to think about that. I think I would have maybe tried to employ it in some way. I don't think I would have gotten rid of the cake, though. You gotta have wedding
cake,
right?
Cake. But this is the perfect Wisconsin. You get this cheese arrangement as your cake while being married at Lambeau Field. I don't know, just on the verge of hunting season, maybe like that. Just bring together all the great Wisconsin traditions in one wild wedding.
Well, here's to a new kind of cheesecake in Wisconsin. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.